Welcome to the Student Housing Insight Podcast, everyone. Hope everyone is doing well. This podcast is supposed to be published on September 11th, which is when Hurricane Irma is supposed to be pressing in on Georgia and the Carolinas. So for all of you who have dealt with the storm and are in its path, my prayers are with you. And as well for all of my friends in East Texas and Louisiana who are still drying out from Hurricane Harvey. It's just a horrible, horrible thing to see all the destruction. And I love seeing how the country has responded with the relief efforts. And again, my best to those folks dealing with that. So in this episode, we are talking about choosing a property management firm for those of you who are developers and owners entering the student housing industry. Greta Dare, who is joining me as a co-host, which I mentioned on the last episode, she interviews me on my background, so everybody gets a good long understanding of that, which several people have requested. So a lot of that is in this episode. But she interviews me on my background and what I've learned that really needs to be considered as you weigh your options. I also want to preface something I say in this podcast that is going to upset some people. Let's just go to the clip. An owner of student housing should never have a third-party manager.
Dun-dun-dun.
Dun-dun-dun.
That was big.
Okay, now I explain exactly what I mean by this, but I just want to repeat it here at the beginning of the podcast so that everybody understands. That comment is really directed to the people I'm creating this first series for, property owners and developers new to this space. If that is you, it doesn't mean that you attempt to manage this asset class with no experience. Find the people, find the consultants, hire the staff that have the experience, but more than anything, be a part of the management team and communicate goals to them clearly. All right, enough on that. Additionally, we talk about my view on what the future college student looks like. I've got some pretty, I think pretty good observations on that I want to share with you guys. Handling project management on rehabs and how to incentivize a management firm. So with that being said, let's get to the podcast. Hope all of you guys enjoy it. Take care. So, hey, this is going to be a little bit of a different podcast.
It is.
First of all, as we mentioned in the last episode, you are now joining the team as a co-host.
Hear that, audience?
Yeah.
They're excited to have me.
So, no, we actually really did, out of the first five podcasts that we put out there, it was actually between you and Jerry Presley, who was talking about internet and Wi-Fi distribution, that were constantly, week after week, were like the contenders for the number one.
Listen, I'm completely convinced it's because people got on mine, they listened to it, and they were so like rage filled with all of those insane opinions that they just started pat. They're like, listen to this chick, listen to her. It's horrible.
So anyway, I did feel like this podcast needed a co-host for certain, just to provide a little bit of a different perspective, and also so that people don't have to just listen to my monotone voice during the whole thing. So
somebody who speaks more quickly.
Yeah, that too. But, you know, it gets edited before it goes out. I'm able to speed things up a little bit and take out all the ums. Speaking of which. So, as we went through the last series, or the first half of this series on development, and really speaking to the part of my audience that is, maybe they're current developers, or maybe they're looking to get into student housing for the first time with a development, and really just need some basic information on what's different in student housing from the development perspective. So on this podcast, we're actually talking about picking a management firm.
Very exciting. very important.
Very important.
Yeah.
You know, when we're starting a new development, or when someone is starting a new development, you think about all the programming and everything that goes into the physical part of the asset, but it's really that management company and their culture that ends up being what, you know, your customers, your residents end up receiving.
Yep.
Or experiencing. So
good or bad.
Good or bad. And it's not just, you know, it's not just being greeted with a warm smile and a hello. It's also, you know, are they doing the things behind the scenes to really deliver on that experience? So that being the case, I'm actually going to be the guest host, being interviewed by Greta on this.
Dun dun dun.
You know, as I've stated in the past, I understand both sides of the deal, but certainly am much more intimate with the operations side than anything else. So yeah, I felt like I'm probably one of the best people to speak to on this.
Plus, and the most humble.
Well, I also didn't want to bring on anybody from the industry and feel like I was given preferential treatment to somebody.
That's valid.
So anyway, I'll turn it over to you now.
All right. Are you so excited? So exciting stuff. So to go ahead and get us started, to kick this off right, we want to know about your background, a little bit about your experience. Please explain to me, sir, why it is that you feel like you have a right to speak about these things to us. Hit me with it. I want to hear the best.
I've just gotten older. I stayed in this industry and continued to age.
Ageist.
And yeah, as you age, you experience things and you gain knowledge and sometimes wisdom, but certainly knowledge. And yeah, so I'm going into my 20th year, but I tell everybody my start really came from being on the ownership side on a very micro level. There was actually my first, what I tell everybody as far as my intro into student housing, was on the ownership side, and it was with a 4-bedroom, 4-bath condo that I purchased my junior year in college, that I purchased with the help of my parents.
I was gonna say fancy
as the co-signer. Yeah, right. No, there was not the credit for Wesley Dees to go out and purchase his condo while he was a junior in college. But no, it was actually a product that you don't even see anymore in the industry that was termed as kiddie condos. And the marketing that basically went behind it, or the thought process that went behind it. Well, first of all, do you know what the most expensive part of going to school is?
Tuition.
What part of tuition?
Living expenses.
The housing.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at, forget about off campus, but
on campus housing, all of it is expensive.
You know, you're looking at a good 60-40 split of what's housing versus, you know, what's actually going for your classroom time. And there were some folks very early on in the industry, Mike Moran with Capstone, my former boss, Wes Bradley's father, Bob Bradley. Both of those gentlemen, some other folks around the country, were very instrumental in starting what was called kiddie condos. And are termed as kiddie condos.
Are you going to explain what a kiddie condo is? Because I have no idea.
So, the purpose behind the condo, just as, and take the scholastic academic part out of it,
okay,
or component to it out of it. Typically, anybody that's single is going to want to look for roommates to help, you know, carry some of that burden of utility costs, rent, that type of thing. The smart person is the one that finds enough roommates that they don't have to pay rent, right? And so that was really kind of the thought process behind this. The objective for those developers like Bob Bradley and Mike Moran that I was mentioning earlier was to provide a unit type, typically a 4-bedroom, that a college student buyer, which was usually the parent, could leverage the mortgage by renting the other rooms out to their friends, therefore cutting out the biggest expense of college, which is the housing. So anyway, I bought a unit with my parents, and basically as them being the co-signers, and
really began learning how to do property management on a micro level. If my roommates didn't pay for the utilities, for their portion of the utilities, I was covering it. If they didn't make rent 1 month, me and my parents were covering the mortgage. So I really, again, at a very micro level, started understanding, what's going to...
It's a good lesson in college.
It was. Fortunately, I didn't have any issues. In 7 years that I owned that condo, I only had one time when someone was not able to pay their rent on time, and they told me about it 10 days in advance and just said, hey, this is what's happening. I lost my job. Passed away, whatever. I'm going to be late on it. Is that okay?
And I'm really hoping right now that you were just throwing examples out there, and this one person that you rented your condo to did not lose their job and their mother in the same week. Because that's literally what you just said.
He did lose his job. And there was something else that happened with, I don't know if it was grandmother or someone else passed away. I mean, it was like, pretty
that's
rough
a
period.
Bad week.
Yeah, yeah. So
I'm impressed that he was able to put it together and be like, hey, I'm not going to be able to pay rent. Anyway, yeah. Sorry, totally off topic.
So anyway, that condo is where I tell everybody my property management experience began.
All right, so you started with a kitty condo and apparently somehow managed to move on from that great property management experience and expand out in some way that we actually continue to care listening to you and companies wanted to hire you and so on and so forth. So what was next?
So going into my senior year, there was actually two properties that were the first purpose-built apartment communities. 100% for rent, wasn't an ownership type deal, which was mainly what was provided at this university before. But this was the first time. Not only was it was it purpose built as far as how the floor plans were laid out and everything else, it was also amenitized.
Ooh.
And the extent
did it
of
have
those,
a lazy river?
No, it didn't. The extent of those amenities was a rectangle shape. Swimming pool with a
so basic.
Depth of, I think, 6 feet at its,
so basic.
at its deepest, and a fitness center and, somewhat of a computer lab.
So basically like conventional housing.
Yeah, but, for, what was this, 1998?
You're so old.
I feel it. I did. but at that point in time, that was the thing, especially in this market. They didn't have anything else.
It still should be, but yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, there was an opportunity for a leasing agent position during lease up for one of these two properties. And the group that was managing it was based out of Florida, had a lot of experience in student housing. But the folks that were managing the property, the local folks, the folks that were that were on site, they didn't have student housing experience, nor had they even gone to college. So they really needed somebody that was able to make that connection to what was going on campus. And so they recruited me, basically because one of my roommates was looking to sign a lease with them. And anyway, long story short, ended up having one of the best summers of my life leasing up that property. Then move-in day came, and I realized it wasn't just about getting people to sign leases. Man, that first property, it was built in... so there was one phase that I think we moved in on August 1st, and then the other phase, like 10 days later. We had no clubhouse. It was just a shell of a clubhouse with a roof over it. And that's what we did move-in day out of.
Nice.
Swimming pool wasn't
so
even...
So a fancy clubhouse to go with your fancy amenities?
Yeah. Swimming pool wasn't even finished. And so that's when I learned the value of an on-time delivery.
And a
sure.
good move-in day.
Yeah, yeah. But no, so I was doing that lease up, and the management staff approached me and said, hey, we've got this resident director position that's going to get 75% off their rent. They're supposed to kind of serve as a liaison between, the management group and...
You had me at 75% off rent.
Exactly. and that's all I really kind of heard. And I was like, yeah, I could rent my room out. I could cash flow the condo, could move in, basically pay, you know, $100 a month in rent. And yeah, this, I could pocket another $200 from the condo. So yeah, let's do it. Oh, if I only knew what that was going to lead to. But basically, you know, kind of finishing out my college career, I really started liking what I was doing there, really connecting the people, a lot of people that were, you know, obviously my peers, but connecting them with a, you know, with an experience that was really going to enhance what, you know, what their college life was going to be about.
I think that's what happens to a lot of people. It's sometime about that period of time they got involved with the university housing and fell in love with the, like, the positive impact situation that they have with students, and then your heart's in it.
After that resident director role and graduation, I decided I didn't want to go into teaching, that I liked real estate too much, and went into commercial real estate for a couple of years.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, yeah. Got, had a lot of fun the first year learning commercial real estate, and then I got bored to death and had to get back in on the residential side. And there were two properties that were built at UNCC when that first one was, that I worked for. The other one was actually the same group that, the other one was built by the same group that, that I bought my condo from,
oh,
which was the Bradleys out of Roanoke, Virginia, at University Housing Group. So met with Wes Bradley, which was just so, it was kind of ironic, because ironic's not the right word.
Fortuitous, serendipitous.
It was serendipity, I think, is definitely the right way to phrase it, because when they got out of the, so here's what happened in 1998-1999 with the kitty condo craze that was happening. HUD realized that with these four bedroom, four bath floor plans, that they really weren't first time home buyer type of mortgages, or first time home buyer product.
Not
and
so much.
They were getting first time home buyer mortgages.
Oh.
And so they basically made a rule to kind of skirt around fair housing that basically said that, you know, bedroom bath parity above three bedroom, three bath, they would not finance, because essentially they saw it as, or I shouldn't say finance, but wouldn't be involved with that program within HUD. And basically what that limited to, now that you were going down to, you know, only three bedroom, three bath, you couldn't get the metrics to work out so that a college student who was wanting to rent the two other rooms and cover his mortgage, it just wasn't going to happen in most situations.
Mm.
So the Bradleys and other folks that were in that niche within the niche began focusing on apartment communities, and that's, you know, what the Bradleys had done with that property, that competitive property. And when that happened, Wes Bradley actually, but when that happened, the Bradleys said, look, we know how to sell these things because we've been doing it on the condo side, but we don't know how to manage these things. And Bob's son, Wes Bradley, was taking over, or had joined the company at that point in time, and he actually spent the first 2 years on site really learning how to operate and manage a student housing community. And so when I was ready to jump back out of the commercial real estate side, he was looking for a property manager. And because we had, you know, worked together as competitors before, it was just kind of natural that, you know, we had a discussion, and he ended up hiring me. And so anyway, it was kind of perfect timing, because as that kitty condo craze was dying off, they began focusing on building apartment communities, and, you know, was able to come in and really help structure, just through that evolution process, really be able to structure a lot of the policies and procedures and things that fit to what he was trying to do as a merchant developer of student housing. And eventually that led to me becoming their vice president of property management. Moved to beautiful Roanoke, Virginia for about 6 years. And then 2008 came and the bubble burst within real estate. And we really didn't feel the effects of it until late 2009 in the student housing industry. And long story short, those guys went on kind of a hiatus with being able to develop. And we and I had to go my separate way because there was I was the vice president of property management. We sold all of our properties, and there were no properties.
Vice president of nothing.
Yeah, there was no properties to manage. So we so anyway, when my time ended there, really the only options were bigger management firms. So I went to go work with one of those. I had 50 conventional properties spread across the company, and they had a small sector, or they had a small group, small portfolio of student housing. It was only 4 properties. And so
I didn't even realize that you had already worked for a company that had conventional with student housing as a section of the business.
Yeah. So anyway, part of me joining them was not only to oversee their student housing assets, from a regional manager standpoint, but also to help them build a student housing division. And worked there for a year and really started to understand that what I was doing for the 3 or 4 properties that, the Bradleys had wasn't going to work, in a company that was, even though I only had 3 or 4, or I should say 4 or 5 student assets, it was not going to work for a company that, planned to get much bigger. So I really had to learn how to, not manage so much with my boots on the ground, but begin managing from a report and through processes. And that was a very valuable year. We did a lot of great things. So, later in 2011, the capital markets really began thawing out, and student housing was kind of the last to freeze up, and it was one of the first to thaw out. So there were a lot of people that were looking at doing a student housing deal because they could get money to do it, but they really needed to find out if their land opportunities actually made sense for student housing. So there were a lot of folks looking for experienced student housing professionals that knew how to do a market analysis, knew how to do underwriting. And so I went out onto my own and started consulting for a lot of clients that were doing that. So there were other student housing companies during that period that I was able to help them expand their footprint by helping them source deals, etc. Ultimately, one of my clients asked me to come on as their chief operating officer. That company grew, and eventually we partnered with another group that created Campus Evolution Villages. CV went from being a portfolio of 5 properties that were fee managed to 23 properties and 11,000 beds, mostly of owned assets. But with that type of growth, my focus shifted to helping the people, our employees grow in their careers and creating a culture that employees wanted to be a part of. And in return, that ends up making customers happy as well, because that site team was focused on helping those residents. Mm.
This is true. You worked on this culture and used it to lure me in.
I did. We. I don't know what else to say.
Yes, you did. You ended up leaving back at the beginning of the year. So what was the story behind that? What's the takeaway?
I left CV.
Because that brings us up to date.
Yeah, I left CV earlier in the year after a lot of discussions with my family and kind of the rest of the C-suite at CV. I was really burned out and out of season, which is, one thing I would really encourage our listeners to do some self-evaluation, because we tend to get, student housing gets a lot of burned out people.
Yeah.
I don't want to necessarily say I was burned out, but I think I was certainly out of season. CV was very much a startup, and we knew it was going to be for the first 2 or 3 years. And it was hard for me to really break away from being in that mode constantly. And it was really time for a change. My family had grown as much as the company had during
those
5 years. We've got 4 kids, and
you guys are ready to make a TV show on TLC with that family.
They're cute enough. We should be able to. But no, we've got 4 kids, 3 of which were born from the time I was with UCH and CEV. So It was time I needed to find something that didn't require so much around the clock attention as what was needed at CU.
Basically, what you needed to do was take your concept of culture for the people that you had underneath you and apply it to yourself in your own life, is what you're saying. And your family.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody's mad at that.
Yeah. So, you know, ultimately that decision, you know, led me back into doing consulting again. And it's been great.
All right. Well, so thanks for that essential wrap up of the life and times of Wesley Deese. All right, so now that we have the history covered, during that period of time from junior year in college up until, you know, we'll say now, not up until the end of last year, but up until now, are there any trends that you've noticed that were noteworthy that are applicable to the world of development or management companies?
You know, I've seen the off-campus industry go from basically a private dorm product. Most folks are familiar with the Dobie Center in Austin, Texas. You know, 27-story.
Everybody knows the Dobie Center.
Yeah, 27-story.
Hasn't everybody managed the Dobie Center?
Not everybody, but I have. it was a product or a property that we managed at CUV for a year before it was sold. But, you know, the Dobie Center, 27-story high-rise, very much built like a private dorm. Or like an on-campus dorm, food services involved, all those kind of things that you would typically see in an on-campus dorm. Granville Towers in Chapel Hill is another example. A lot of this stuff was built, you know, in the early 70s with what is now EDR, but used to be Allen & O'Hara, and they were actually kind of the first author of the individual bedroom lease. So, you know, I've seen it go from that type of product to more of a conventional garden style type of product to, you know, even now, and we're kind of coming out of this phase, I think, but the single family cottage style product as well that Landmark and Capstone and a lot of those companies have been.
Aspen Heights.
Yeah. You know, I've seen Tier 1 schools become oversaturated with inventory and bounce back. I've seen Tier 2 and 3 schools introduced to the product and just becoming oversaturated and can't sustain healthy occupancy. Good example. Indiana, Pennsylvania, Statesboro, Georgia has seen it a couple of times. As they've continued to grow. But anyway, in combination with that, I think the general college degree has lost a ton of value. Technology is evolving too fast for universities to push out a knowledgeable workforce. I've yet to have a marketing student talk to me about, you know, how they're learning to use Snapchat to engage a customer to lease. I think we're going to see, you know, and this is just a subject matter that's kind of close to my heart. You know, me and my wife homeschool our kids, so my view on the education system in this country is very different from most. So I want to go ahead and kind of set the tone for that. But, and I want to make a lot of people upset within this industry.
You already made them uncomfortable by saying you're a weird homeschool person. You're good.
Right. but, you know, technology is evolving too fast, as I mentioned. And I think we're going to see more of the trade schools and institutions like Adam Braun's Mission U or Seth Godin's Alt-MBA and see a very different type of college student in this country. It doesn't, you know, just because they may go to something that's more of a trade school or something that's more of a independent course doesn't take away from the fact that they're still a student and they still, you know, need to live someplace. Yeah. Kids that are doing that see value in those type of courses. It's still going to take, you know, a good amount of time. You know, typically a year to 2 years, maybe even more. They're going to be working during that time, and they don't really want to live with mom and dad necessarily.
Well, I'm just going to totally interrupt you because I completely agree with you on the trade school point. And I think that the one of the number one deciding factors behind that right now has been the student loan, the major student loan issue that's out there. These kids are filled with debt. And the number one piece of advice that they are all turning around and giving the people behind them is to go to a trade school.
Yeah, I mean,
because they're not making
enough.
Don't get me
wrong. I'm not talking about the, you know, that there's going to be crumbling institutions.
Oh, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that we are just going to see an upward trend, kind of like we did with online universities, and I think that's probably on its way out.
Yeah, I do think. Well, I don't know.
No, with the for-profit ones, I totally shouldn't have made a generalized statement like that.
the second and third tier schools, I think, are going to certainly
stop
the third tier.
Yelling at me, audience.
The second and third tier, especially the third tier schools, I think are going to be hurt by this.
Oh, yeah.
You know, colleges aren't going to be going away. And, you know, doctors, I don't want my surgeon going to a trade school.
No.
You know, or to, you know, Adam Braun's Michigan.
Go to Harvard.
I don't want, you know, the person, the architect that's building my plans to go into something like that. So, anyway, my point is there are always people that are in professions that are going to be going to college. And, you know, tier one schools, major research universities are always going to be great sources for this partnership between the private sector of building off-campus housing and the universities. But anyway, my point in all this is the trend that I see coming. And I think it's going to change the way a college student, the way we view college students. It doesn't take away from the fact that they've got to live somewhere, and that they're going to want an individual bedroom lease, that they're not going to have to worry about the roommate not coming up with ever, you know, with their portion of the rent. And, you know, I say all this because that evolution can really be strategic if a management team that's on the ground is listening to their residents and reporting to ownership what they're hearing. You know, amenities like co-working or incubator space or art and graphic design studios and even recording studios, those are going to be a huge attraction to Gen Z students. So you need a management team that, you know, not only communicates these needs, but they are also able to support these needs and can work with the university and other stakeholders to pull things together and capitalize on these type of offerings. Everything else in student housing is property management and customer service, which is just another commodity at this point. You know, good student housing operator has to do those things well, plus understand the needs of college students and the needs of supporting institutions. So that's where the trend is headed. I see that it's headed. And if you're going to be a different, if you're going to evolve with that, you've got to be looking for it. Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years down the road? I don't know. I think a lot of that can really be determined what happens, mainly from technology, and second, you know, government policy. Honestly.
Yeah, I think it's a great observation.
Well, thank you.
So then, what would you say is most important when planning a development in student housing or hiring a property management company to oversee the operations?
Again, I'll reiterate what I just said, that it is a property management skill set plus understanding the needs of students and colleges and figuring out, you know, is there a way to fill those needs that they have. Sometimes that need will have nothing to do with housing, but you may be able to allocate resources to help. A couple of examples, you know, pushing a wellness plan that the student affairs is trying to get 90% participation from their enrollment in. You know, these things are not only, those type of things aren't only important to the mission and agenda of the university, but someone's actually going to be, it's actually someone's job to achieve that, and you know, being able to help them achieve that is going to get you a lot of runway of being able to do other things with the university.
Absolutely.
That's needed. So, you know, next point is your customer isn't just the renter. You have to communicate with their parents as well. And a good student housing manager gets that and have figured out systems and their systems for making the parents feel like they're part of the community and the experience as well. Peer-to-peer sales is another point that is, a new developer or anybody new to the sector has got to get comfortable with, which means that, your leasing agents are going to be very young. Therefore, there's a longer ramp-up time with training, and managers need to understand how they are going to connect and motivate that young staff who haven't declared a major, much less thought about a career track. I think the last point is, everything is based on the academic cycle, not just leasing, but operations as well. This means August and September create cash flow concerns. So a good student housing manager understands that and will be focused on making sure funds for that period of time are being escrowed in advance and not distributed to ownership based off of quarterly earnings and that type of thing. They're accruing this stuff and accounting for it so it doesn't, someone doesn't get a cash call, halfway through September.
And these are all really great, I think, talking points. So in the event that somebody is listening to this and they, are in negotiations with property management company or they're planning their site, whatever the case may be, these are great points to bring up and questions to ask to that company. But I think one of the key things to remember as well is to ask for the proof of these things, because anybody can sit down with you and they can tell you that, they put the customer first and these are the things that they do and these are the people they've hired and this is what they're passionate about and this is what the company's focus is, and sell you a really great line. And that's, they may very well be passionate about all of those things and want to put the customer first. But you need to ask for the proof. You need to ask what kind of systems they have. Can they send you examples? Can you see any type of documentation that's utilized? What do their policies look like? What do their procedures look like? Can you see these physical items? Because unfortunately, you are going to need proof that these actually exist, and you have every right to see them.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, so with all of that said, when should an owner consider self-managing versus hiring one of the third-party management companies? I really like the look on your face right now, and I'm sad that everybody listening can't see it, because I'm really excited for what it is you're about to say.
Well, I'm going to upset a lot of people without going to answer this question.
Finally, someone besides me.
But, it's what I believe will always produce the best product and customer experience and ultimately the best return on investment. An owner of student housing should never have a third-party manager.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
That was a big, one. I feel like you need to add, a sound bite in there.
I probably will. I will. If you're planning to own anything that generates revenue, but especially student housing, no one is going to manage it better than yourself. It's just true. And
please tell me that you're going to throw in the fact that that doesn't mean that these people who are experts in development or construction need to learn student housing or think that they know student housing. No offense, people who are super smart in other areas, but it doesn't automatically mean, obviously, that listening to this or, going to a couple of conventions and talking to some friends, that you now have the ability to properly manage a student housing development.
It doesn't mean that you're going to be very good at it initially, but what it does mean that you're going to make the decisions that reflect your goals and strategies for the investment. So one of the biggest issues that we have in this industry are investors and ownership groups that don't communicate to their site teams. They don't communicate to the universities and other stakeholders their intentions for developing the project in the first place or owning the project. And because of that, there's a lot of assumptions that are made and trust is not ever built with these stakeholders. You've heard me say over and over again, businesses move at the speed of trust. And if site employees assume that, you're like any other owner or the only owner they know, they will assume, the exit strategy will be to, build a nominal value and take your 7% and let the property become part of someone else's investment strategy. And if that's your plan, that's perfectly fine. But explain it to that team, and you've got to do it on an ongoing basis, because remember, you've got students that are graduating every 4 years that are working for you. So it has to be repeated over and over again. And most importantly, you've got to teach them, you know, how they're going to be how they will be rewarded reaching those goals. They'll take pride in knowing they are helping you to be successful. Let me back up and give kind of an example. You know, when I was working with Wes Bradley, and we were a merchant developer, we were building with the purpose of selling. Everybody on staff at the site level knew that, and they knew. I mean, we set them down and said, "Hey, this is our goal. This is our intention.
Good on you guys.
We want you to be a part of it, and because of that, this is what we're going to pay you if we're successful at it." And there was never any question. There was no, you know, the question I got asked the most is, "Hey, are we ready to sell the property yet? And you know, how are we doing on getting things ready to take it to market?" Because they were bought into that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't about how much they were getting. It was just they felt like they were a part of making something happen. So you got to have buy-in from all those employees. You know, they'll take pride in knowing that they are helping you to be successful, and therefore understand why they are coming to work every day and how to approach the decision-making process more than anything. If they know that they're in year three of a five-year hold, they're going to know how to approach CapEx projects and that may or may not be needed. You know, from my observation in this industry over the past two decades, when third-party management is in place, there's this breakdown of this communication, and it turns disastrous. You know, I get that the owners worrying about intentions of selling, et cetera, will cause the staff to disengage. And I'm telling you, it's stupid. I've had much better success by telling the management team when I'm hiring them that, hey, we are building this property with the sole intent of selling it 2 to 3 years after we deliver it. If we're successful in this, here's what it means for you. Here's what I've done in that. I've established trust, you know, the common goal and how they're going to be rewarded. And if they view that as, well, I don't see how I'm going to grow with this company, there are high chances, you know, that those same people would have left you, you know, 12 months into it anyway. So you don't need that person. It's two separate goals. And it's just a, like I said, it's a scenario for disaster if you can't get buy-in from those key staff members.
I love that. I can tell you right now, being somebody who was at a property that was for sale, that was something that definitely, you know, made a huge difference, is knowing actually what's going on and feeling like people respect you enough to share that information and get you on board. So I fully agree. All right. So with that stuff being said, obviously, do you have an opinion on how third party, that actual management process, is good or an example of goodness or successful or something positive?
So, you know, the times where I've seen third party management succeed and be the most helpful and really serves a purpose is with, you know, institutional or sovereign funds where typically the hold is going to be longer than a merchant developer, and those management groups doing that today are doing it pretty well, and they do it well for those clients. The track record isn't as strong for groups that are merchant developers and property flippers wanting a third party management group to handle all the day-to-day. It just isn't. And I don't think anybody listening to this podcast who's looking at their, you know, first student housing deal is gonna, you know, that they're gonna be able to do anything any different. I will say if you're a merchant developer or an opportunistic owner of student housing and you still want a third party manager, you know, look for someone who can JV on the deal. Or at the very least, build incentives based on, you know, what the actual exit strategy is that you're looking at. They need to have some skin in the game, and trust me, that will pay off in the long run. If you're not willing to do that, you seriously need to reconsider what the hell you're doing getting into student housing.
Boom.
Boom, yeah.
So then, new development versus value add. What are the challenges of managing those two types of assets until they are stabilized, would you say?
So, you know, let's start with new development. You're selling dirt and a dream. So make sure your people know that.
I love that.
well, I mean, it's true. It, it's how many leasing trailers have you been on where there's absolutely nothing but what's inside those four walls of the leasing trailer and a bunch of architectural drawings? Maybe you had some good graphic tools, maybe you have some virtual reality technology that you're able to show folks inside of a leasing trailer. But for the most part, it's really about how well you are at selling an experience completely sight unseen.
I mean, I've seen some pretty swanky lease-up offices where they've got like a whole model built in, and it's like a million miles away from. So I already dig the dirt in a dream, but I'm sure that pun wasn't intentional, but it was funny to me. So, I think that there are better ways to do it, but even if that's the case, it's, regardless, you still can't see the community, you still can't see the amenities, and you're just using the visual depiction of the expectation of what it should be if it finishes on time.
Yeah. My other comment on new development, you got to make sure the team knows the project is going to be delivered on time. And the minute you find out it may not, make sure the staff knows it and that they know that you are working on a plan to make as many people satisfied as possible.
Yep.
If you don't communicate the potential delay to the team, they will assume it anyway and they will stop leasing because, they know that they're the ones that's going to be facing the music with those tenants or students and parents. So have a contingency plan and make everyone know what it is. Someone that you and I both know in this industry, she was on a lease up, and starting in like April, she was like, "Wes, I just don't know how we're going to get this done. I don't know how we're going to get this done as far as the building, the construction." And I'm like, "Look, there's a lot of experience behind it. Don't worry about it. Just be focused on leasing." And, they're at the same time, the students are looking at it and their parents are coming in. They're like, "Oh, no, you're not signing a lease here. I've been in construction 35 years. There's no way that's going to be done on time." And the fact is, those parents, don't know what student housing general contractors will do in order to get. I mean, I've seen them rent out, indoor basketball facilities at high schools in order to, build the trusses and the walls and everything and get it on site so they're working 24 hours. But if a general manager or a lease-up manager doesn't know that and hasn't experienced that, they're going to get this sense of, I don't think this is going to happen, and I'm the one that's going to have to face the music on this. So.
Well, and they also need to know that they have your support, because they're going to be down there, and let's be honest, they're the ones who take the brunt of the angry residents and the angry parents. And to not feel like your corporate office or, those people have your back and that they're going to get yelled at as much as you, I'm not buying into this. Screw you. Deal with it. Yeah. Oh, find another job.
But there was that particular situation we were talking about. It was literally the night before move-in that they came in and said, "Yeah, we're not going to get a CO on that particular building, on that last building." And, fortunately, we, didn't have, it didn't cause any issues. It did mean that there was not going to be a vacant bedroom on the site. And we started calling people that night and saying, "Look, we know you're scheduled to move in tomorrow, but this is what we've just been told."
See, I take issue with that, though. Like, he should have communicated that sooner.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why I bring it up.
Yeah.
That's exactly why I bring it up, because there was between that person and that developer, there was now a trust issue.
Yeah.
And, because she's been sitting there for months saying, "Wes, I don't see this happening. I don't see this happening. Make me feel comfortable with it." And, what I was saying, what the developer was saying, is it's going to happen, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And it didn't happen. And the thing is I think everybody really knew that it wasn't going to happen. But it really kept her from, I think she could have leased stronger and been more focused on things that she needed to be focused on had you know, they'd at least said a week in advance, yeah, it's going to be a push, but you need to come up with another plan.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, I've said that before to, you know, another company or a group of guys that we worked with that built a property. It's late deliveries do happen. They happen all across the country. They happen every year. Yeah. And it really isn't the end of the world. In fact, it could mean for a better lease up and better word of mouth if it's handled correctly. And the only way that can handle correctly is if everybody's honest and tells the truth and says, hey, I don't think this is going to happen.
Well, I don't think
you gotta have that plan.
I don't think it's a thing of someone not being honest. It may be an issue with people being honest with themselves.
I mean, that's still honesty.
But I think it's really more, they don't want to stop the, it's this fear of, if I tell the site team that it's likely not going to happen, they're going to stop pushing and for leases. And that's completely asinine.
Well, they don't have to tell the site team if they think it may not happen. You still need to tell the developers, need to make sure that the corporate office or whomever is in charge of that site team, that they're aware of it so that a contingency plan can be put in place. And then once you do get closer, be it 2, 3, you know, even 1 week out, to let the site team know, you know, hey, this isn't actually going to happen. We're totally on the same page.
So, you know, again, going back to that, you know, mentioned that initial challenge is, you know, selling dirt and a dream. You've got to have a property management firm in place that understands the power of social media and being able to do weekly video updates, really showing, you know, what's happening on the ground and giving those customers who've already signed leases, those other potential customers that are on the fence, give them the opportunity of seeing these things come together, you know, tell that story, show that story on a weekly basis so that they see progress happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the biggest points is, and we've actually seen this before, that if the property is an older property and they're going through, you know, multi-million dollar renovation that includes amenity areas, clubhouse, the actual units themselves, that the leasing team can utilize that. Because, you know, I've seen it a million times for new development and remodels where nobody believes it until it's been done. And if you can actually have those renderings of what the final product is going to look like, but additionally the construction as it goes through, to prove to those students and prove to those parents, especially if you're in a market where you're having to overcome a bad reputation as shoddy product and that's, you know, what you decided to buy up and redo, you need to be able to show that stuff actually going through and have that displayed in the leasing office so that that team knows that they can use it as a selling tool.
Yeah, and that's a perfect segue into value add, because you were talking about, you know, renovations and you know, value add versus new development. You know, the things that are true for new development are still true for value add opportunities, especially if they're interior unit renovations that are going to take place. You want to be doing that social media. You want to be making sure that your site team is aware of the progress. You know, so the other thing I'll say about value add, and I hope everybody really leans in to hear this, but don't make anyone, if you're doing a value add and you're doing a renovation, don't make anyone on the management team a de facto project manager. I've seen it happen over and over again, and it's a failure. And
so bad.
If you ask them to do it, they're going to do it, and they're going to fail. You know, they're going to do it because you the owner of the management company, you know, told somebody or requested it on site, and you know, it's their chance to shine and you know, make themselves more valuable. I'm going to tell you, it's going to be a huge distraction for them, and not only are they going to fail at being a project manager, they're going to fail at doing what they were hired to do. It's not their skill set. You know, they were already hired to perform other duties. When those duties don't get done, you'll have a hard time terminating them. Hire an owner's rep, a project manager, a consultant, Providential Student Housing.
Was that out loud?
It was out loud.
Yeah, it was.
But don't get on-site staff involved with...
I've actually been that person. Did you know that fun fact about your dear friend? Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I was a leasing manager, and I oversaw all the way down to, so we had a full remodel, and I was so freaked out about it because we were completely remodeling these interiors, and it was new cabinetry, new countertops, you know, sinks, fixtures, everything. And, you know, it was, all right, we want you to handle this. And I was like, I know nothing about cabinets. And I, you know, me being me, I'd spent like 24 straight hours on the YouTubes and, you know, Googles and trying to figure out everything I could learn about cabinetry, you know, and then came out with these opinions. And I could show you pictures like, this is the kitchen that Greta designed. Kitchens by Greta. And I think about that now, and I'm like,
how many leases did you miss?
Why did anybody think that was a good... No, but honestly, do you know what happened? And this isn't better. That kind of work that I did, which I did, I had a lower number of signed leases, but it wasn't drastic, because that work that I did meant that me, as a very low salary paid employee, I spent so many hours. It's actually how I made, you know, my huge best friend in the entire world, because she was a leasing consultant side by side with me. And we spent, you know, we were there until 10 or 11 o'clock at night and doing all of this stuff. And, you know, honestly, I was grateful for the experience. It was, you know, one stop along the way of a great career. But I can tell you, I would never lay that expectation on one of my leasing managers ever. I think it's wildly inappropriate, because it doesn't happen that often where somebody's going to have that weird level of dedication and focus that she and I had. You don't find those people that often. And you hired them because of their strength, utilize their strengths, and yeah, absolutely build on, you know, those other areas, but not for something so important as literally picking out the cabinets and making sure that the entire apartment's done and punched. And don't do that. Don't do that to the on-site team.
I mean, it's just... Well, and that, as an owner, why would you want to do that?
I don't know.
Why would you want... I mean, you know, obviously, you know, leasing agents and leasing managers are certainly, you have got to be focused on that sales process. And I could see it even, you know, that de facto person becoming a maintenance supervisor. Well, okay, who's plunging the toilets? Who's making days
overseeing the work orders and making sure they're done in a timely manner?
Yeah. And it's just a distraction. So,
people do the job that you hired them to do.
Yeah, hire an owner's rep, a project manager,
Providential Student Housing.
Just don't get on-site staff involved with your GC, except with, you know, getting status updates and communicating with residents. And, you know, if you decide, you know, to be the project manager yourself, be the project manager.
Oh.
Don't involve staff, and don't, you know, let growing your business distract you from being the project manager. I've seen, you know, too many times where, you know, a property owner says, well, no, I'm not going to pay somebody, you know, 15%, 4%, whatever it ends up being, to be the project manager on it. I'll just do this myself. And, you know, that person's sitting in an office focused on growing his, you know, his or her business, and leaves 15 minutes in the day to basically check up on the progress of that rehab project. No, that's not what's needed. It's not fair to yourself, and it's certainly not fair to that general contractor. And at the end of the day, the results are going to show for themselves.
Great.
Other questions?
No, I think that was a lot. There was a lot of really good points in there. This is probably a ridiculously long podcast, so congratulations if somebody made it all the way to the end. All right, great. I think that covers a lot of stuff in a very large amount of time. Yeah, that's me making fun of Wes for having really long podcasts. So congratulations if you did make it this long. We're super excited you stayed with us. And honestly, I think it was a lot of great, great information all the way to the end. The project manager, I'm being dead serious. Stop looking at me like that. This is valid stuff. And hopefully that it's heard. And, you know, I think worst case scenario, when in doubt or when questions, reach out to multiple resources. And obviously you're one of them, because, you know, don't just assume that you can go at it alone. But with that being said, Wes, I'd like to thank you for coming in and being a part of Student Housing Insight today. It was great having you as a guest on my show. And I look forward to all of the possible interactions that we may have in the future. Is there anything that you'd like to add for my listeners?
No, I appreciate you bringing me on the show. And yeah, again, manage the property yourself. If you can't manage the property yourself, make sure you're incentivizing the property management firm based on what your goals are for the property.
And ask for proof of all the promises. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Greta.
Bye.